taking more than a casual glance over the hill. Gary and I were then confronted by Walt's body, still lying on the road beneath the blanket I'd placed over it. We looked at Randy for help. She shrugged and took the direct approach. "Katie, what do you want to do with Walt's body?" Katie looked at Randy, unsure.
"I don't know," she said. "What should we do?"
Randy looked back at us. "We don't have anything for burying him, Katie," I said. "We can leave him here or we can take him with us and see if the town has any arrangements for the dead." She sighed heavily, her eyes tearing again.
"Let's take him. Can we do that? I don't want to leave him here with the people that took his life."
The arrangement for transporting Walt's body was less dignified than I would have preferred. The ATV trailer was on the small side, about 4 feet wide and 6 feet long. In order to make everything fit and to avoid soaking all the gear in Walt's blood, we had to place his body on the bottom, still wrapped in the blanket. We placed the guns beside him, along with the sack of gear we'd recovered from the people who'd attacked Katie. We covered the guns and Walt's body with our individual packs. We would still keep our personal weapons handy, but it seemed prudent not to ride into a strange town on stolen ATVs with weapons on display. As we prepared to head out, I looked at Randy. "You ever drive one of these?" She gave me that look again.
"I'm a country girl," she said. "I was practically born on one of these."
"Gary," I asked, "what about you?"
"I've ridden motorcycles all my life, ATVs only a couple of times. I know the basics, though."
"Then how about I drive the ATV with the trailer?" I suggested.
"Gary, you can take one for yourself. Randy, you take the other, and Katie can ride with you. We have a little more than 7 miles to go. Surely to God we can get there without getting killed or having to kill someone else."
Chapter 21. The day was somber and quiet for Ellen and her family. Pete had been very upset last night after shooting the two intruders. Pops had taken guard duty for the rest of the night so Ellen could lay with Pete and help him get to sleep. He'd asked a lot of questions, and she didn't have answers for all of them. She grieved for what circumstances had forced their son to do. It made her worry more for Jim and long for his return. It was only after Pete fell asleep that she could think about her own actions and how she had reached the point where she could so resolutely and easily end a man's life. Pete had slept late that morning and felt somewhat better after breakfast. He helped Pops use the excavator to block the gates with a series of steel beams. The beams were scrap from an old bridge and weighed more than 500 pounds each. They had several of them and placed them at intervals all the way up the driveway. It would make it very difficult for anyone to drive up to the house. With the lay of the land being so steep in this area, you couldn't just drive around them. There was a hill on one side and a steep embankment on the other. With this road blocked, the farm road at the back of the house would be their primary way in and out. With more time on their hands now, Pete and Pops also took the box of driveway alarms Jim had purchased and began installing them around the house. They had a limited range, but would set off an alarm in the house when the devices sensed movement. Pops explained that the sensitivity of the device may require some fine-tuning to avoid false alarms. In the meantime, they could expect dogs, cats, possums, or even cows to trigger an alarm, so every signal would have to be visually verified. By the same measure, they couldn't depend entirely on them and forgo guard duty. There would still need to be a live sentry at night. By afternoon, everyone was focusing on their chores. Ellen was cycling the generator to keep the freezers and refrigerators cold. Nana and Ariel were running a canning operation. They'd hot-packed many of the meats from the freezers, and there were jars cooling on every flat surface of the kitchen. They had the pressure canner on the back porch heating on the side burner of the gas grill. They still had a lot of frozen foods left, but were trying to save as much as possible. They'd already put up thin-sliced beef for sandwiches, beef cubes for stews and soups, and several varieties of chicken and pork. One of the nice things about this canned meat was that it would be much easier to prepare than the original roasts.
Pete had also led Pops to some of Jim's tools, and they'd decided to barricade the front windows. They'd found some scraps of 1/8-inch plate steel that they'd placed over the windows using 3-inch lag screws. Some windows were covered with a single piece, while others were pieced together from 2 smaller scraps. This method left a shooting port that could be accessed by raising the window sash from inside the house and sticking a gun barrel through the horizontal gap between the plates. When they ran out of steel plate, they found some pieces of 3/4-inch plywood that they could double up over the remaining front windows, creating an 1.5-inch thick barrier. These barriers might not stop a bullet, but they would slow one down and would minimize the risk of flying glass. While Pops and Pete were putting up their tools, they heard a call from the gate. Pops spun around and put his hand on the butt of his pistol. Pete ran for his rifle that he'd leaned against the house. "That's Henry, isn't it?" Pops asked, squinting toward the road. Pete returned with his rifle and looked. "I think so," he said. The man at the gate waved at them and started climbing over it. Pops started walking down the road toward him. "Go tell your mother that Henry's here," Pops said. Pete ran for the house. Henry and Pops met about halfway down the driveway.
"Well, hey there," Henry said. "Didn't know you were staying here."
Pops shook Henry's hand. They'd known each other for years, although Henry was about 10 years younger than Pops.
"We came down yesterday," Pops said. "Ellen was a little worried about being here by herself. We decided to come help her out with the kids and all."
Henry nodded.
"Probably a good thing," he said. "That trailer park worries me a little."
"Ellen's been saying the same thing," Pops said, not wanting to bring up last night.
"It's like they're turning into some damn tribe," Henry said. "I came by there last night, and I swear they were roasting big chunks of beef over an open fire. They had a fire built out of a wooden deck they'd torn off one of their trailers and were roasting some meat they'd skewered with a piece of rebar. I stopped by because I knew it was somebody's cow, and I wanted to make sure it wasn't mine."
"How'd that go?" Pops asked.
"I got out of the truck with the rifle in my hand and asked where they'd got the meat. They didn't want to say. I kept asking. One of them tells me he hit a cow with his truck and they butchered it."
"You believe it?" Pops asked.
"Could be true," Henry said. "Could be a lie. There are a lot of cows running loose right now. People are too damn busy living like pioneers to check their fences like they need to."
Pops nodded.
"They showed me the cowhide, and it wasn't my cow," he continued. "I told them that I'd better not have any cows turn up missing, or I'd be straight up there to pay them a visit."
"How'd they take that?"
"There are some rough characters in that trailer park. If it does come to that, I'll take some backup and be prepared to shoot. I halfway expected someone to start something yesterday, but they let it go."
Pops nodded, but didn't say anything. Henry looked around, feeling no pressure to speak. Farmers were like that, content just to stare at the land and not say much sometimes. Henry threw up his hand and waved. Pops turned to find Ellen and Pete approaching.
"What brings you down, Henry?" Ellen asked.
"Just wanted to check on you guys," Henry said. "The Kaisers that live between me and the trailer park said they thought someone tried to break in on them last night. Their dog got a hold of them, though, and they ran off. You all seen any trouble?"
Pops turned to Ellen, gauging her reaction.
"No," Ellen said. "Not really. A bunch from the trailer park came down here yesterday wanting food, and I had nothing to give them. And we heard some shots last night."
"Really?" Henry asked.
Ellen nodded.
"There were several," she said. "I got up and looked out the window, but didn't see anything. I couldn't really tell where they were coming from."
"That right," Henry said. "Couldn't hear anything from my place, but that ain't surprising the way sounds bounce around in these hills."
"Yeah," Ellen said. "I reckon it could have been anywhere up or down the road. I couldn't tell."
Henry mulled this over.
"Well, I got to get back to work," he said. "Keep your eyes open. I think things with these folks will get worse before they get better."
Pops nodded.
"I think you're right about that, Henry."
"Call me on the radio if you need to," Henry reminded them.
We may have to team up on these trailer park people if they keep acting the way they are. They seem to feel like they're entitled to take what they want. I've got news for them, though. With that, Henry turned and walked off. Chapter 22. In the end, it was my eternal predisposition toward sightseeing that saved my life. I was in the lead, and we were puttering along cautiously on the ATVs, winding our way down the mountain. Coming around one bend, I could see Lloyd's Town in the distance, easily recognizable by the tower of the town hall. I turned sideways, raising my arm to point toward it. "There's the town," I called to the others. I had barely closed my mouth when everything went to shit. A strand of barbed wire that had been lying across the road hidden by leaves was suddenly jerked tight to the level of my neck. Because of the way I was turned sideways with my arm upraised, the wire caught the inside of my bicep and dislocated my shoulder, rather than catching the inside of my neck and dislocating my head. In an instant, I was lifted from the seat of my ATV and thrown backward. In another fluke of timing, I landed on my back in the trailer I was pulling, then continued rolling backward into the road. The trailer broke my fall sufficiently that I was not severely injured, but I hit the back of my head on the pavement and lay there stunned. Randy, riding behind me, reacted quickly and swerved to the left, only missing me by a tight margin. A little further back, Gary eased off the throttle and slammed on his brakes. Even with my eyes closed, I could identify the hollow sound of ATV tires skidding on pavement. I could not tell that everyone was focused on me, but they must have been, because no one noticed the man with the gun climbing down the high inside bank of the road until it was too late. "Don't move a damn muscle," he said, leveling a pistol at them. I recognized the voice, but continued to lay still, my eyes closed, my head spinning. I could feel warmth spreading under my arm, blood running from the deep burn of a gash. The son of a bitch had sliced me open with the wire. A barb had gone under my armpit and cut me at the same time that it was dislocating my shoulder. The pain of the dislocated joint was excruciating, and my only defense right now was to feign unconsciousness and hope that I could get a jump on the guy. My shoulder screamed, and it was all I could do not to writhe with the pain. It felt like a red-hot knife was being twisted around inside the joint. "Turn them damn things off," he yelled, gesturing at the four-wheelers. One ATV turned off, then the next. I had no idea where mine had ended up. I could only hear the ticking of cooling engines and the scuff of footsteps walking across the pavement toward us. "You're the bitch that killed my little brother," the man said. "And now most of the rest of my family's dead, too. Any good reason I shouldn't shoot all of you right now?" No one replied. "I got my own good reason to not shoot you," he told them. "It's because I want to slice you open and let you bleed to death slowly. I want you to have time to think about the mistake you made when you crossed my family. That sound like a party?" I cracked my eyes open as faintly as I could and saw the man stood in front of Randy, an old revolver in his hands, pointed right at her. Katie sat behind her, eyes wide in fear, already traumatized by her encounter with these people. "Looks like you got a little cut there on your cheek," he told Randy. "We do that?" "I didn't do it to my damn self," Randy answered defiantly. "We're going to do more than that in a minute," the man said. From my cracked eyelids, I saw the man slowly insert his index finger in his mouth and suck on it. Then he pulled it from his mouth and moved it toward Randy's mouth. He rubbed his wet finger across her lips before forcing it between them. She did not cooperate, but she never closed her eyes, never wavered from his direct gaze. "Open your mouth, bitch," he hissed, putting the gun to her forehead. She let her jaw go slack, and his finger probed her mouth, stroking around, moving in and out. He smiled the disturbing smile of a pervert. Then his smile turned to shock, then pain, when Randy bit his finger as hard as she could, grinding it between her molars as she attempted to pulverize it flat. When the man's brain was finally able to process the incoming flood of pain signals, he responded quickly and backhanded the revolver across Randy's face. She crumpled, and the man slowly drew back his injured finger, shaking it as if he could shake the pain free. The finger was bleeding heavily. Randy clearly had bigger balls than most men I knew.
"You're gonna hurt for this, bitch,"
the man hissed, raising his foot in the air, his intent clearly to stomp on Randy's face and head. Gary must have stood in response because I heard him call out in anger. The man spun toward Gary and fired a single shot. So much for killing everyone slowly. Katie screamed when Gary dropped. The man turned back toward Katie, steadied his pistol, and shot her in the face without a word. My assessment of this man as a sociopath appeared to be accurate. He was a cold-blooded, remorseless killer. Knowing that I would be next, that the man would put a bullet in my head just to make sure I never rose again, I took the opportunity to grab for my handgun while he was still deciding what to do with Randy. Because my right arm was injured, I had to reach across my body with my left hand. The gun was not positioned for a left-hand draw since I was right-handed. It left me grabbing the weapon awkwardly by the handle and having to lay it down on my belly before I could take it back up in a proper shooting grip. It was a difficult move that I wished I'd drilled on, but it was too late to worry about it now. Fortunately, the safety was ambidextrous, and I was able to find and release it after a second's bobble. I raised the gun just as the man began to slowly turn in my direction. The front sight wavered over his body, and the 9mm barked once, catching him in the lower left quadrant of his back. He spun, and I hit him again in the chest. He dropped his gun, clutched his chest, and remained standing, his eyes glued on me. I fired again, steadier this time, and hit him in the throat, tearing out a chunk. A gusher of blood erupted and completely saturated him before he fell over backward. I dropped my gun, unable to move myself and hold it at the same time. I crawled toward the closest ATV and used my good hand to pull myself up. I could do nothing until I reset my shoulder. Trying to recall how to most easily reduce the dislocation by myself, I could think of nothing I could use except the ATV. Every movement of the injured arm was excruciating. I leaned over and clamped my hand as tightly as I could around one of the steel tubes that supported the cargo rack. The support was at thigh level. I straightened my back. In an explosion of movement, I used my legs to propel my body straight up while holding to the ATV as tightly as I could. There was a burst of pain, then a pop, then a wave of relief as the shoulder joint reseated itself. I let go of the rack and spun around in a daze, eyes watering, clutching my arm. I was suddenly aware that my head ached from the impact with the pavement, and I felt dizzy. I fought to stay conscious. I remembered the shot, Gary, and my gun on the pavement. I had killed a man. Randy had been knocked out, or had she been killed? I couldn't remember. I scanned the pavement for my Beretta and leaned over for it. I probably would have passed out from the motion of bending over had I not experienced a fiery wave of pain from using my recently dislocated shoulder to grab for the gun. My mouth filled with vomit from the pain and dizziness. I spit it out. I passed the Beretta to my left hand and checked the guy I shot. He was dead. I kicked his pistol to the side in case he experienced some kind of spontaneous resurrection. I wasn't taking any chances. I scanned my surroundings and saw no movement. I moved to Randy. There was a whopper of a bruise forming on her left cheek and around her eye. I touched it to see if the cheekbone was broken, but it didn't seem to be. The pain from my fingers probing the bruise made her stir. She'd be okay. At the rear of the ATV, Katie lay on the ground in a pool of her own blood. Her face was a misshapen and damaged pulp. It was a wound no one could live with, nor would they want to. I delayed checking Gary. I did not want to see my friend dead. He'd taken a round, and it had dropped and silenced him. I had nothing to treat a chest wound. If he was still alive, it was possible we could have gotten him to town to a doctor, but there was no sound, no cries of pain, No pleas for help. I had to assume the worst. He was dead. What would I tell his family? I stepped around Gary's ATV and studied his fallen body. There was a puddle of blood beneath his head, probably from hitting the pavement. I watched him for a moment and was shocked when I saw his chest rise. I immediately crouched and began looking for the wound, ready to plug it despite the inevitable futility of it. I finally found an entrance wound, but there was no blood around it. I set my pistol down, put my left hand over his chest, and probed the wound with my finger. But it felt odd. I found hot metal. I drew my finger back and ripped open the loose button-up shirt he was wearing. Body armor. Gary was wearing fucking body armor. "What happened?" asked a voice behind me. I spun, making myself dizzy in the process. My head throbbed, and I felt a wave of nausea. Randy was standing there, probing her face gently, checking the wound as I'd just done with her a moment ago. "He took a bullet coming to your aid," I said. "I thought he was dead, but he's wearing some kind of body armor." I finished unfastening his shirt, spread it open, and it was clear that his vest had caught the round and stopped it. Of course, I also knew that blunt trauma over the heart could be fatal in its own right. I removed the Velcro straps under his armpits that held the vest in place and lifted the vest up. There was no evidence that the bullet had penetrated the vest, no blood underneath it. "Bring me some water," I said. Randy went to her ATV. I heard a loud intake of breath.
"Katie," Randy said. "Oh, sweetie."
I realized that Randy had already been knocked out when Katie was shot. She hadn't known. "Water," I reminded her, trying to draw her attention from the grim scene in front of her. In a second, Randy was behind me, passing me a bottle of water. I unscrewed the cap and splashed some across Gary's face. He stirred, then bolted upright immediately, his eyes wide in fear. He started gasping, trying to take in the scene, trying to figure out if he was dead or alive. He frantically patted his chest, searching for a wound. He found no bullet hole, but did grimace in immediate pain when his fingers probed his ribs. "Oh, Jesus," he croaked. "I've got a broken rib." I put a hand behind him and eased him back down onto the pavement. "I'm sure you do," I said, "but you're still alive. A broken rib we can deal with."
"The vest," he said. "Police surplus, kept it in my bug-out bag."
"Why didn't you say anything about it?" I said. "I didn't even realize you had it." He reached for the water bottle and took a long drink.
"I never said anything because I felt bad that I didn't have one for you guys. I felt guilty."
I laughed. "No need to feel guilty, man. The damn thing saved your bacon."
"Katie's dead," Randy said.
Gary's smile left his face, and he looked around at the scene surrounding us. He shook his head.
"On the practical side, there's no need to haul these two bodies any further," Randy said. "We can put them to rest off the road somewhere. Together."
I looked at Randy and nodded. Not sure I really had any words left in me for this experience. It just kept getting crazier every day. How long would it take us to get home? How many bodies would we leave behind? Would we all make it?
Chapter 23. Throughout the day, Ellen and her family focused on the variety of jobs that needed to be performed to keep things functioning. They continued to run the generator at intervals, processing frozen meats into longer-lasting products for the day the generator fuel would run out, slicing some into jerky and dehydrating it. Some roasts and steaks got cut into cubes and canned in the pressure cooker. They used the grill for this, heating the pressure cooker on the gas grill's accessory eye. They tended the garden, charged batteries, and scanned radio stations for news. Even all the basic tasks, such as cooking and washing dishes, now took much longer. Above all, they maintained vigilance, keeping an eye on the road and the perimeter of their property. There had been more traffic today on the gravel road at the front of their property. Several different groups had gone by, both on foot and on ATV.
There was even a pickup that coasted slowly by earlier, the bed full of people. Whoever was on watch kept a set of binoculars handy and dutifully reported what they observed. From what they were seeing, it appeared that folks were looking for the missing men, the ones that Pete had shot last night and Ellen had buried in the pasture. Later in the evening, they had a dinner of rice topped with canned soup. It was a simple, filling meal that was easy for a group. They ate it from paper plates with plastic utensils, which limited cleanup to the pots used for making the rice and the big spoon used for serving it. At the children's prompting, they concluded dinner with coffee, hot chocolate, and some cookies. While they sat around enjoying dinner on the back porch, the clanging at the gate came again. Ellen was instantly filled with anxiety. Conversation came to an end, and her anxiety turned to anger. She grabbed the AR-15 that lay nearby, stood, and shouldered it. "Pops, I'll need you to cover me from the truck. Let's go. Use the 870 shotgun," Ellen said. "You'll have good coverage if you need to use it." Pops nodded, obviously distressed by how things were turning ugly. He was a social being and not prone to violence. Ellen drove toward the gate. She could see the pickup from earlier stopped in front of it. A man and a woman stood at the gate, beating on it with a stick. Ellen drove to within 20 feet of the gate, stopped, and threw open her door. She exited the vehicle but remained behind the door, speaking to the group through the open window. "What the hell do you people want?" she asked. "I thought I told you I had nothing to give you." The woman at the gate was the woman Ellen had spoken with yesterday. "We're looking for my husband," she said. "He didn't come home last night." Ellen thought about this for a moment. "What was he doing out last night?" "Hunting," the woman said. Ellen mulled that over. The men had been hunting, all right. Hunting for things they could steal. "We haven't seen him," Ellen said. "We heard shots last night," said the man standing beside the woman. Ellen assumed it was the woman's son. He looked to be around 17 or 18 years old. "We heard them, too," Ellen said. "They didn't come from here."
"You mind if we come through and look for him?"
the woman asked.
"I fucking well do mind," Ellen replied.
"He shouldn't have had any legitimate reason to be on my property, so I don't see that you have any reason to go tearing through my property looking for him."
"I ain't asking," the boy said, tightening his grip on the top rail of the gate. "I'm fixing to come across this damn gate, and I better not find out that you done anything to him."
Ellen raised her AR and leveled it at him.
"I'll kill the first person that steps onto my property."
The group stood still, apparently certain that this was not a bluff on Ellen's part.
"You kill my husband?" the woman asked.
She appeared to be on the verge of tears.
"I didn't kill anybody," Ellen replied coldly. "But if your husband was out stealing from people last night and got himself killed, he brought that on himself, didn't he?"
The woman stared back at Ellen just as coldly.
"If we have to steal to feed our families, we'll do it," she told Ellen.
"Then I'll just lay it out here plain and simple for you," Ellen said. "We're done talking. I ain't coming to this gate anymore to powwow with you folks. My suggestion to you is that you head out of here and see if there are any government shelters or something set up to help people. I strongly suggest you don't try to start stealing off your neighbors around here, or a lot of people will end up dying." No more words were exchanged. Ellen climbed back in the truck, reversed up the driveway, and parked the vehicle behind the house.
"That went well," she said. "Wouldn't you say?"
Pops was shaking his head.
"I think we should just get out of here and go back to our house in town."
"No," Ellen said. "You all can leave if you want, but the kids and I are staying here. It'll probably get worse than this in town soon, because there are fewer people with the resources to grow their own food. We can survive here for a long time if we can manage this conflict." Pops patted Ellen on the arm.
"I just don't want to see anyone get hurt," he said. "I couldn't live with it."
She looked at him, and there were tears in his eyes.
"I don't want to see anyone hurt either," she said. "And we have a backup plan that would be safer than the house. Maybe it's time to use it now."
"A backup plan more secure than what Jim already set up for you?" Pops asked.
"You have no idea," Ellen said. "We have a cave, a fortified cave.
Jim's been working on it for years.
Chapter 24 The rest of the ride down the mountain was surreal, riding the smooth pavement of the parkway down into the town of Crawfish. The road was empty, although there were a few abandoned vehicles sitting on the shoulder or pushed off into the ditch. We passed no other people until the road flattened out into farmland, and then we saw a few folks. A farmer splitting wood with a heavy maul stopped to watch us go by. I started to raise my hand into a wave, but the pain from the dislocation curbed my gesture. It wasn't likely that anyone would have waved back anyway. Such was the consequence of being a stranger in a strange land. As the land became more populated, dogs barked at us, and children watched us from behind fenced-in yards. Adults eyed us through screen doors and windows from deep within the shadowy interiors of their powerless homes. We drove on, slow enough to stop if we came upon a hazard, but fast enough to discourage anyone from stopping us to chat. In front of a ramshackle sharecropper's house, we drove by an old man in a T-shirt and a diaper standing beside the road, bearing silent witness to our passage. His mouth hung open, his eyes empty, and his hand wrapped around the neck of an old open-back banjo that he'd been dragging behind him. The diaper appeared close to collapsing under its own weight. The pain of my dislocated shoulder continued to rack my body, made worse by the effort of steering the machine. Several times a sharp pain in my arm made me hug it to my midsection, trying to alleviate the pain. It did not work. When we could stop, I would take the strongest pain medication I could find and pray that Lloyd had some kind of liquor put back for company. 25 minutes after our journey began, we passed a crooked green sign that welcomed us to Crawfish. It was a railroad town that in its day had been the crossroads of this community. It was where people arrived to and departed from. It was where the community's cabbage, beet, and tobacco crops had once left for markets. It was where the local payroll for long-closed industries had shown up on the train for disbursement. At its peak, it had held sprawling wooden hotels and spas with siding of local poplar clapboards. There were mineral springs where the sick came to consume the limestone spring water and to purchase bottles to take home with them. Now, it was the sleepy bedroom community for larger nearby towns. It was where college professors moved to restore Victorian homes and open bookstores that few ever visited. I had never entered the town from this direction, always coming from the interstate. When we reached the railroad tracks, the dead center of the town, I killed my engine and tried to orient myself. Randy and Gary pulled alongside me, killing their engines also. "Is this it?" Randy asked. I nodded. "Just trying to get my bearings," I said, looking around. From the corner of my eye, I saw Gary cock his head. "You hear something?" I asked. "Sounds like music," he said. I smiled. "That would be it," I said. "Follow that banjo." "You're asking us to go toward the banjo music?" Randy asked. "Didn't you see Deliverance?" I cranked up my ATV, pulling away from Gary and Randy as they exchanged glances. I turned off Main Street and passed a restored railroad caboose donated by the railroad and sitting on a short section of rusty track that led nowhere in either direction. I swung a right turn back up a street and in the distance could see a series of storefronts that were all part of a single immense brick building. That was it. With Gary and Randy bringing up the rear, I headed in that direction. The building was one of the oldest in town, dating to just after the Civil War. A wide wooden porch connected all the storefronts, and each one had its own awning overhanging the porch, just as it would have over 150 years ago. There was an electric barber pole mounted to the brick, stilled by the lack of power. One of the wide plate-glass windows had a painted sign that read, "Lloyd's Barber Shop." And beneath that a script read, "Haircuts, Shaves, Lies, Music." Indeed, as I came to a stop and killed my engine, I could tell that the entire front of the building was practically vibrating from the sound of banjos, guitars, fiddles, and an upright bass playing traditional old-time music. The music trickled to a stop, and an odd assortment of faces appeared in the expanse of the dirty window. Some wore old-fashioned hats. Others had unwashed hair that pointed from their head in violent shocks. Finally, I recognized Lloyd's face among his musical brethren, and he broke out in a grin. A moment later, the door swung open, and a man in the antiquated dress of a 1930s hillbilly musician burst onto the porch, a silver revolver protruding from a vest pocket. "Brother Jim," Lloyd said, "you look like hell." I smiled a weary smile back at him. "I feel like hell. What's going on in there?" "I had folks over playing when all this shit went down," Lloyd said. "They just stayed. I don't even know how long we've been playing or drinking, but it's been days." "Got room for more?" I asked. "We need a place to stay for a day or so while we regroup and try to get some supplies. We've come all the way from Richmond, and we're trying to get home." Lloyd, always host to an inappropriate sense of humor, locked eyes on Randy. "Well, that's no problem. We've got plenty of room, and I see you brought a woman to trade." Lloyd winked at Randy about the time her hand was creeping toward her pistol. "Careful, Lloyd," I warned. "Our humor's a little low at the moment. It's been a hard trip. The world has pretty much gone to shit." Lloyd gave a little laugh. "The world has always been shit," he said. "You're just now noticing. I noticed a long time ago. Why do you think I live in the past?" "Got a place we can hide these machines?" "Garage is open," he said. "You'll have to make a place for them, then come on inside. You'll know a few of these boys." Epilogue. I stood on the sidewalk outside of Lloyd's barber shop, watching the sun settle over the horizon, casting an orange glow over the pastures surrounding Crawfish and over the white clapboard walls of the old Victorians that filled the town. I sipped moonshine from a plastic cup and listened to the thump of old-time music. I couldn't remember the name of the song. Maybe something about an Indian in a pumpkin patch. As we'd hiked these last few days, my grandfather had been on my mind a lot, providing a well of strength and hardening my resolve. As day faded on the town, I was remembering the end of his life. He'd had a massive stroke and had spent several days in ICU. When they'd finally moved him to a room of his own, my dad and I made the 4-hour drive to visit him. My mom and uncle had been with him since they'd first gotten the news of his stroke, but they'd been the only visitors allowed. It had looked like my grandfather might survive, barring any further strokes, but he would not be the same man. He was paralyzed on one side of his body. His speech had also been affected. All of these things were relayed to me by my dad on the trip over. He didn't want me to be shocked by what I found. Shock was inevitable, though, when we reached the hospital in Williamson, West Virginia. The vital, powerful man I'd known my whole life, the man who'd been indestructible in my eyes, was decimated by the stroke I saw as soon as I walked into the room. My mom sat at his bedside, holding his tanned, rough hand. He did not turn to face me. I wasn't even sure if he was awake. My dad prodded me in the back, and I moved closer. As I approached his bed, my mom turned and smiled painfully, reaching out to me with her other hand and squeezing my arm. I was 17 at the time, but I'd felt instantly a child again. From where I was standing, I could see that my grandfather's eyes were open, but he did not turn to face me. I walked around the bed until I was directly in front of him. It took everything in me to do that. His face was slack, and saliva ran from the corner of his mouth and down his chin. I'd never been so close to this kind of personal devastation. I felt paralyzed, too, completely without control of my body and mind. I raised my hand slowly and put it down on my grandfather's shoulder. He was not a person who touched a lot, and it was an alien gesture in our relationship. However, it was all I knew to do. He twisted his head violently into his pillow, startling me. I jumped. I could see tears in his eyes. I knew that he felt ashamed, in pain that I was seeing him that way.
We stood that way for what felt like hours, all of us locked into this painful moment from which there seemed no escape. It was broken when my grandfather twisted his head back in my mother's direction, catching my eyes briefly as his glance passed over me. He raised his left hand, the one my mother had been holding, pointed at her and my father, then pointed at the door. He made a sound, a soft grunt that sounded like, "Row."
"You want us to go?" my mom asked.
My grandfather pointed again at her and my dad.
"You want to be alone with Jim?" she asked.
My grandfather bobbed his head in an awkward, jerking nod. My mom looked at my dad and rose slowly, the two of them leaving the room. I had no idea what was going on. My grandfather turned his head slowly back to me and caught my eye. I was frozen, shaken to my core by the depth of pain and anguish that I saw there. His glance did not leave me for a long time. I felt as if he were transmitting a steady stream of regrets, goodbyes, and things left unsaid. I heard it all, watching until his eyes drowned in the tears that began pouring from them. He pointed to a notepad and pen sitting on the rolling tray table by the bed. I got it, and he gestured that he wanted to write something. I lay the pad in his lap and placed the pen in his good hand. With great concentration, he scrawled in large, shaky letters, "Bring gun." My eyes widened, and I looked at him.
"No," I said, my voice a mixture of fear and anger.
I was completely appalled that he would ask that of me, that he would consider doing such a thing to himself. When he looked up at me again, what I saw was not anger at my refusal, but desperation. Those eyes told me that I was the only person he could ask. I felt a crushing mantle of responsibility drop on my shoulders. I felt sickened from his request, but imagined myself in that bed, unable to carry out my final wish, and unable to convince anyone to help me. Would it be love to condemn him to rot in this bed, never walking the woods, never seeing the river flow behind his house again? Is that how I would repay the man who helped shape me? I would have to do it. I would have to be the man he was asking me to be, knowing that I could never, ever speak of it to anyone. I would help kill my grandfather.
"Where can I get one?"
I asked slowly, my voice low in case anyone was listening. He placed pen to paper again, scratching slowly, writing, "Red toolbox, basement, loaded."
"In the red toolbox in your basement," I repeated, "and it's already loaded."
He nodded at me.
"When?" I asked. "I don't want anyone to know I brought it to you."
"Tomorrow," he wrote. I frowned.
"We're leaving tomorrow," I said.
"We're going to go back home for a couple of days." He stared at me, desperate, his thinking not clear enough to help me solve this problem, but his will was clear. I knew in my heart that what he was asking me was truly what he wanted. This was not the delusion of a sick man. It was not shock from the suddenness of his plight. He would never get better. He would never be the same. He would never be happy again. In everything I knew about the man, I knew all of that to be true. I thought about the situation.
"We're staying at your house tonight," I told him. "I'll get the gun and take it back home with me. I'll come back in a few days. Instead of driving to school, I'll drive here. No one will ever know I was here."
This was in the days before video surveillance was in common use. There would be no record of my visit. I could walk in, slip in the gun, and leave unseen.
"Can you hold a gun?" I asked.
He awkwardly raised his hand, turned it to his head, and curled his index finger as if he were pulling a trigger. His eyes met mine. He could do it. My heart broke. We had made a bargain. The following Friday, I left for school as if it were any other day.
My parents had plans to return to West Virginia that night after they got off work. I had 8 hours to get to his bedside and back without raising any concerns. It would be tight. Under my seat, wrapped in a red bandana, was a Colt .38 revolver. I'd wondered why he stored the gun in the basement in a toolbox instead of upstairs with his other guns. The question was partially answered when I removed the gun from the oily rag in the basement and found that the serial number was ground off. Perhaps this gun had already killed a man before. Back in Williamson, West Virginia, I parked in a half-full lot outside of the hospital. The gun was tucked in my jacket pocket, still wrapped in the bandana. I pushed through a glass door and took the elevator to the third floor. I knew where I was going and exited the elevator confidently. I looked up and down the hall. It was empty. I walked to my grandfather's room. The door was closed halfway, and I pushed it open. He appeared to be asleep, the light from the window illuminating him in a way that made him appear very peaceful. His features were relaxed in a way that they had not been a few days earlier. I shut the door behind me and walked to his bedside. I considered turning around and leaving. He would probably never know I'd even been there. I could not live with the guilt, though. The knowledge that his final feelings toward me were not love, but disappointment and betrayal. I leaned over him and whispered in his ear. His eyes opened slowly, taking a moment to focus on me, to understand who I was and why I was here. I was the Grim Reaper. I was death come to take him. He smiled with his half mouth, and his eyes teared up again. He mumbled, and I knew he was thanking me. "Do you still want to do this?" I asked. He looked me in the eye and nodded. "I can't let you do it while I'm here," I said. "No one can know I was here." He nodded again. "If I slide it up under your hip and cover it with the blanket, can you get to it after I leave?" He nodded. "I will miss you," I said, my eyes beginning to pour. A sob racked my body. "No," he hissed at me, clearer than anything he'd said since his stroke. I knew what he was saying. He was telling me to harden up. And I did. I dried up the tears and controlled my breathing. "I love you," I whispered. "I've got to go." His eyes stayed glued to mine.
"Love you too," he said,
slightly garbled but understandable. I knew he meant it. Hard as he was, he loved me. I pulled the hood of my gray sweatshirt over my head and strode out of the room without looking back. Passing no one in the hall, I opted for the stairs to avoid standing around in the hallway waiting for the elevator. I left the building, drove back to Virginia, and as far as I know, my visit there is a secret that only I hold. I got home around the normal time, but my parents were already there. When I walked in the house, I heard my mother's sobbing and knew that he had done it already. I was surprised to feel relief along with my grief. I was happy that he was released, happy that he had left on his own terms. Our mission was a success. They never learned how he got the gun. My mother was certain that one of his old buddies had slipped it to him. My dad never voiced his theory, but he looked at me differently. I wondered if he suspected, but he never asked. In Russell County, as darkness settled on Ellen and her family, they gathered for dinner around a battery-operated lantern and ate their meal while Ellen shared her plan for the next day. Jim's parents were not thrilled with the idea, despite Ellen's assurances. Pete and Ariel were so excited that she suspected they would have a very difficult time going to sleep. Moving to Jim's cave would be a lot of work, but it was the safest option she could imagine.
1 mile up the road from Ellen and Jim's home, a grim cabal shared a meager dinner around a campfire in the yard of an older mobile home. A few folks had left over the past few days, hoping to find shelters or relatives that would take them in. A little more than 20 folks remained, including their children. They would not leave. For one thing, revenge burned in the hearts of some for the missing men who had not come home. For another, it seemed that the family up the road had plenty of supplies. At one point, they had heard a generator running up there, and they suspected there might be stored food. All they needed was a plan, and it could all be theirs. Outside the town of Crawfish, an ancient man stood in a kitchen, prying the lid from a mason jar. He poured the home canned tomatoes from the jar over top of the green beans he'd poured from another jar already. He set the pot of beans and tomatoes on the eye of the old wood-fired cookstove that had been in this kitchen since before he was born. While he stood waiting for the pot to heat, he heard heavy steps on the porch. He knew that the thuds that accompanied each step were the sound of his son's banjo bouncing off each rotting step as he climbed them. This was confirmed when he heard the sound of the banjo dragging across the porch. There was a creak as the screen door behind the old man opened. There were more steps and the scrape of the dragging banjo coming across the floor.
"Mommy?" moaned the man with the banjo.
His voice was too loud and his word as ill-formed as he himself was. The older man turned and faced his son.
"Mommy didn't come home, Lawrence," he said.
"Nobody did. I don't know what the hell happened to them." Lawrence, himself ancient and diaper-clad, the product of a genetic abnormality, considered his father's words, his mouth agape, eyes slow to register his slower thoughts. A social worker had once tried to get them to send Lawrence to an institution, assuring them he'd get excellent care and would be happy, but his parents had not allowed it. Lawrence was their son, and his place was at home. The man and his wife were both in their 80s now, and they'd started to consider that they might have to make other arrangements for Lawrence. Now the man was afraid that it might be too late for that. Lawrence raised the dirty hand holding the banjo and pointed it toward town.
"Bobby, four-wheeler, go town," he said.
His pronunciation staggered and awkward. The words were long, drawling, and atonal. The old man set down the wooden spoon with which he was stirring the tomatoes and green beans. He turned to his son.
"You saw your brother Bobby going to town on his four-wheeler?" the man asked.
Knowing this could not be the case because he'd seen Bubby leave with Lawrence's mother and the rest of the family this morning. They'd gone up their parkway searching for their other missing son.
"Bobby four-wheeler," Lawrence said. "Not Bubby."
"You saw Bubby's four-wheeler going into town with someone else driving it?" the old man asked. Lawrence grinned and nodded. The old man returned to his beans, thinking over what his son had just said. If there was another man on his son's four-wheeler, then it meant he was probably dead, because Bubby would not have given up his four-wheeler without a fight. If his son was dead, they were probably all dead. He watched Lawrence silently strumming the stringless banjo that he held across his lap. Saliva pooled in the toothless maw of his mouth and ran freely down his chin and neck. The old man knew that he could not care for his child on his own. Even at 64 years old, Lawrence was still his child and required every bit as much care as he had when he was 4. The old man would pay town a visit tomorrow and see what he could find out. If a man went through town on his son's four-wheeler, someone would have seen something. He would start with the barber, the one who was always asking questions about the old days. The one who played music. The one who had given Lawrence his banjo. When he found his son's four-wheeler, he would kill the man riding it. This has been The Borrowed World, a novel of post-apocalyptic collapse, Volume 1, written by Franklin Horton
narrated by Kevin Pierce. Copyright 2015 by Franklin Horton. Production copyright 2015 by Franklin Horton.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.